Testing, 1, 2, 3, okay, there we go. All right, now sometimes as speaker you have to step out of your comfort zone and do something that you're unfamiliar with, and this is kind of unfamiliar territory for me, but speaking without notes really. I just have the slides that you have that you'll see, and hopefully it'll come together. But I don't know if you're like me, but, and I've titled the sermon Arabian Prophecy because in the Bible you really don't see anything about the religion Islam. Although the religion Islam is very important in the world in terms of being one of the major religions in the world with over a billion adherents, you don't, to my knowledge, see any evidence of that religion in the Bible. Now, the descendants of the people who were the ones who basically have become Islam, you can find those readily, and we'll find those today. So I titled the sermon Arabia in Prophecy because the birthplace of Islam was in what is now called Saudi Arabia. That's where Muhammad was born. And I think most of the rudimentary information, I think most of you know that Muhammad was influenced by Judaism, by Christianity, and was an adherent of many gods. And he and his family believed in many gods. As the religionists say, they're polytheists. So they believed in many gods, many of the gods from all of the other great societies of times past, Babylon and Rome and all of them. They all believed in many gods. They're all polytheistic. But the one thing that Muhammad saw that was successful with the religions at about 600 AD, Judaism and Christianity, was that they believed in one God. And the God that he chose to take from his pantheon of gods that he and his family worshipped was the moon god. And that is why the symbol for Islam, I didn't put it in the slideshow, that's why the symbol for Islam is the crescent moon and the stars. But make no doubt about it, Allah is the moon god, and people that are ignorant, and many people in this nation, quite honestly, are ignorant of the fact that, you know, when people say, oh, well, they just call their God the same God, they believe in the same supreme creator God as we do, that's simply not true. The only thing that he hit upon that was similar to Christianity and Judaism was the fact that he worshipped one God, and he saw that that lessened the confusion. But the birthplace was in Saudi Arabia, even though that's an artificially contrived nation, as you'll see, in terms of the people that live there, in terms of the natural borders and everything else that were anciently there. Those were all drawn by the British Empire. Most of them were drawn by the British Empire. But I know if you're like me, but if you are like me, you like to kind of put things down on paper and list them out. And that's what I've tried to do in presenting this particular information, which will include scriptures, obviously, that talk about the people who are adherents of Islam in this day and age, and why that is important to us in this day and age, and why it's important to us in the church as we preach the gospel, is because, well, you remember last year the religious springing up of the Muslim Brotherhood in ancient Egypt, and the deposing of Hosni Mubarak, who was a very strong dictator, also an ally of the United States. He was deposed, arrested, he awaits trial, he's on appeal. And President Morsi, who is a member of the Muslim Brotherhood, took his place, and he was just deposed in the last few weeks. So they've had another uprising. So, again, if you're like me, it's easier to understand the events, and it's easier to understand all of the consequences of what has led up if you understand some of the terminology. And I'll have to admit that the reason I put this sermon together was because I wanted to help educate myself a little bit more. And when these terms that are tossed around in the news that we hear every day are bantied about, that I might have a better understanding of them myself. I think I had a cursory understanding. I think I have a little bit better understanding. I think that maybe you will too, but you may know more about it than I do already. You probably do know more about it than I do, but I think to be able to differentiate the terms and where these groups have originated from, where these people have come from, certainly from our biblical record and understanding who they are, I think it's very, very helpful. So I'll ask Joe to turn to the next slide, and we see all of the different populations of all of the countries that are considered Middle Eastern and Islamic nations, except for one, which is Israel. And you see all the various populations of all of the Islamic nations, most of them 90% or better adherents of Islam. The most populous nation of Islamists is the Indonesia, which is a series of islands that you know about in the, you know, east of the, or west, pardon me, of the, east of the Indian Ocean. I'm getting myself turned around in the globe here and wondering which is east and west. But east of the Indian Ocean, a series of islands, and that, by the way, is where our president, President Obama, spent part of his childhood, and he mentioned it even recently of growing up and going to an Islamic fundamentalist grade school. And he was a, although it's not widely known, he was taught in a Muslim school. That was the religion that he grew up with from the time of his birth, as a matter of fact. And he only came to Jesus, as he puts it, when he moved to Chicago, became a politician, and went to a church in which there's an individual by the name of Reverend Wright who brought him to Jesus and taught him about Jesus later on in his 20s, even his early 30s. So, but he mentions how he went to, you know, the kind of Islamic equivalent of a parochial school. So, but that's the most populous nation of Islamists. And so when you take a look at all of these nations and all of the makeup, you realize that this is incredible. And if you think the greatest number of them are far away, that may be true. But if we go to the next slide, take a look at the real estate in the next couple of slides of all of these nations, which are predominantly Muslim, beginning with actually even some parts of India, Pakistan, even some parts of what used to be known as the Soviet Union, some of these nations, some of these areas, many of them. This is a fairly recent map. The map of the former Soviet Union has changed quite a bit. But in the southern part, certainly a lot of the Muslim faith, Turkmenistan, certainly Iran. These aren't even counted in the nations that I put on the screen. But when you begin with Pakistan all the way around Saudi Arabia, the birthplace of Islam, Yemen, Oman, all of these nations are very, very important, all the way up to Turkey. And then around, if we go to the next slide, you'll see the massive impact of Islam throughout the Middle East. And, of course, during their conquest of Spain, they pushed Islam from Spain up into even France and some parts of Europe. But from Morocco, generally speaking, from Morocco, Algeria, Libya, which has been a point of controversy in the last year in the United States for obvious reasons, and then to Egypt, where you've had the most populous nation, the uprising that has just recently taken place. I think it helped me to understand some of the divisions of Islam and why perhaps you may have been able to predict. I didn't even think about it, but maybe you would have been able to predict the downfall of the Muslim Brotherhood at this time because of how it happened, how it came about. And so all the way around here, somebody showed me a map not too long ago where you could place the continental United States into the top half of Africa. And I think that's probably true. This is a massive area. And you'll notice that one little stretch of land right up near the Mediterranean Sea where the only non-Islamic nation is. So just to give you, that is pretty, you know, it's a flat map, but it's not to scale in that sense. But it gives you an idea of what Israel is surrounded by and what those people face on a day-to-day basis. So let's go to the next slide there, Joe. So the population of all of the nations around Israel is almost 500 million people. I mean, just surrounding them. And the population of Israel, a little bit less than the population of Jews in New York City, because there are 9 million Jews that live in New York City, from most reports, and 7.7 million Jews live in the entire state, the modern state of Israel. No matter what people think or what side of the fence they fall down on, they have to realize, after all of these years, that these now 7.7 million people are a pretty resourceful bunch. And what they've been able to do with the desert land in Israel is quite interesting. They were the inventors of even things, little small things like drip irrigation. Some of you may have drip irrigation at your home. They kind of invented it and modernized it and made it something that was a necessity, because not oil, but water is the scarcest resource in the Middle East, and something that they have also been pioneering in terms of desalinization plants, which other groups of people have done. So they pull the water out of the Mediterranean Sea and desalinate it to help with their water needs. So it's all very interesting. So let's take a look at this next slide, where this shows you just the little strip of Israel here. Not all of this West Bank area is not all controlled by the state of Israel. But the interesting history is that, of course, many of you know that in 1917, the British overtook the Ottoman Empire, defeated the Turks, and basically laid claim to all of that land. And it was the British Empire that beat and defeated the Ottoman Empire, which had held the area of Palestine for over 400 years. And so basically it was theirs to determine what they would do with it. And so they kind of carved it up amongst the people. You see these kind of unnatural lines of Jordan. There was an area called Transjordan prior to that time. And then Saudi Arabia was another artificially contrived state, Syria somewhat the same way. And a lot of that was kind of carved up by the British to what they thought was fair for the various peoples that were living in those particular areas. And it was in 1917 that an act of the British Parliament passed what was called the Balfour Declaration. The Balfour Declaration provided for what we'd eventually know to be true, the establishment of a Jewish state in Israel, but it didn't happen in 1917. It was just there. The reason it didn't happen was that World War II hadn't happened yet. The impetus for allowing the Jews from Europe and other parts of the world to migrate back and establish their own independent state, there are a number of good books that have been written on this topic, was the fact that they're almost exterminated by the Nazis in World War II. And so the provision was made, and finally it happened, so that they were able to, it wasn't a bloodless coup, let's say, but they attacked and they overtook, and the British allowed this to happen, and they were powerful enough to make it happen. And so the Jews reclaimed their land. And it's not the point of the sermon today, but at the end, I think you'll see that from a biblical standpoint, this area of the world, actually, especially this area around Jerusalem, does belong to Judah because God gave it to them. And that's clear as a bell from that Bible students have known and will know. You will know it if you don't know it. But that gives you an idea of the landscape currently of the Middle East, and you know, that very, very small slice of land, and then the huge land mass surrounding it that is controlled by the Arabs. And in the next spot, we find another famous map, important in the Bible, important in biblical history. No, this area right here is the second largest county in the United States, Pima County. It's where we are right now. And I think it's second largest. I can't remember what. First largest probably got to be in California. That's the largest, and that includes probably all the desert areas and everything. Mojave Desert, okay. Thank you very much. But this county is pretty big, but it's just a small part of Arizona, as you know. So take a look. The area of Pima County is a little over 9,000 square miles. The area that is controlled by the state of Israel is less than that, 8,000 square miles. So if you can easily drive around Pima County, which I'm sure you can drive all the way out to Ajo, then I'm not saying that it's easy to get around Israel, state of Israel, because I've never driven in the country, so I don't know. But it just gives you an idea of the landmass that we're talking about. It's not that much. Just wanted to, and for me, it just helps me to understand the comparison angle of what we're dealing with and what these people have to deal with on a day-to-day basis. So going on. Now, these are the really strategic geographic areas, and from the 70s, we have known how interdependent we are on oil, getting less so by the day, it seems, in the United States, despite the environmentalist wackos and nuts that don't want us to drill for oil and that sort of thing. But I had a friend that I had a hard time believing this the other day. But these areas are very vitally important because much of the world's commerce, a lot of the world's oil, I'll give you the exact percentages, that travel up from the Persian Gulf, the Strait of Hormuz, and into the Suez Canal, and that's a much easier route for ships and tankers to go up the Red Sea and then go into the Mediterranean Sea by way of the Suez Canal. And the important strategic aspect that the United States military has played for decades now is that we have more battleships and destroyers and aircraft carriers than the next 13 nations combined. And so the rest of the world has allowed us kind of to get by with some of our problems and difficulties that they don't like us for because, as I mentioned during the Kingdom of God seminar, we're able to patrol all these areas with ships like the USS Vincent, a huge aircraft carrier, USS Ronald Reagan, which oven by itself, those two ships have more firepower combined in them than all of the armies in every war combined up until World War II, until and past World War II. One or two of these aircraft carriers, more destructive capability than mankind has ever had, just in the two. And they've been patrolling, and they're on patrol right now, and it's nighttime over in the Persian Gulf, and that's what they're doing. And that's what's keeping the balance of power right now is the United States. But you may have read in the news, although it's not the point of the sermon, you may have read in the news recently how there is kind of a strategic retiring of many of the old guard, many of the people who have been generals for a long time. It's very suspicious, not the topic of the sermon today, but nonetheless very interesting. This is that area where these are what Mr. Armstrong wrote about in the 1950s and the 60s. They're sea gates. They're areas that we have controlled, and occasionally you'll find there's some radical nut on a speedboat or in a pontoon boat filled with explosives, and he'll try to ram a battleship or an aircraft carrier, right? And that happens right in there, and there's an important choke point right there. All of this has to be kept clear. It's kept clear today by military power from the United States, sometimes from Britain and sometimes from the European Union, but predominantly by the United States. So this green line shows the route to around the Cape of South Africa, to which makes it a much longer trip to get up to Europe or anywhere else. So much easier access, egress, up into the Mediterranean Sea, and boom, out you go, up to the North Atlantic, and the delivery of oil is made possible. Strategically, again, I think I mentioned this during the Kingdom of God seminars, one of the things that has kept the price of oil down for us is that it's priced in dollars. Other nations have to buy dollars in order to buy oil. If a time comes in the future, which many economists predict will happen because our currency is being devalued by the printing presses and the continual monetary easing, et cetera, if that happens, then we're going to pay a lot more for our gallon of gas than we do today. Other nations pay more, and much of that increase in the cost of gas, where it's priced in liters in England and Germany, let's be frank about it. It's because they tax at a much higher rate a gallon of gas. But there are smaller distances to go in Europe, and some of these countries are about the size of our backyards, you know, Liechtenstein and Luxembourg and so on. Well, they're certainly not as big as Pima County. They don't have as far to drive. But can you imagine having to pay $7 a gallon for gas? Well, there was a time when you said, oh, well, I didn't think that I'd have to pay $3.50 or $4 a gallon of gas, and I did that. But actually, when you look at it relatively speaking, the price of gas, some would say, in terms of what a dollar buys now as opposed to what it bought earlier, may be on par with what it was when it was priced at $1.50. I haven't done a really good analysis of that, but yeah, you could say, well, I'm paying $3.50 a gallon for gas now, and I shouldn't have to, and I didn't have to in the past. Well, in the strictest terms, it's about on par with everything else that has gone up in price. Now, quite honestly, if you ask me, and not that I'm an expert, but I've done enough research to know that we could be totally out of this entire mix with the right policies. In 5 years, the United States could be independent on energy. And there was a time back in the 60s and the 70s where, you know, the population bomb written by Paul Ehrlich, and we're going to run out of natural gas. I remember when I was a senior in high school, I remember this vividly because we had a natural gas company bring one of their trucks up and give us a demonstration and everything. And I asked one of the people that was executive for the natural gas company, which I think was Potomac Power and Electric or something like that, what is our supply of natural gas? At that time, guess what it was? The known supply and reserves of natural gas in the United States. Anybody know? No, the not the price, but the supply. Okay, so it went down from the time you were in college and the time I was in high school, which they estimated about 40 years. Now we probably have at a much greater rate of use of natural gas. It's one of the most abundant resources in the entire world right here in this country. We probably have enough natural gas in our neighboring state of New Mexico to fuel our country for a couple of hundred years alone. And then there's known reserves in Texas and Houston and everywhere else. This is natural gas, what I use to heat my home, probably a lot of you use to heat your home. And we've got oodles of it. And the surprising thing is that with a little bit of research, I was listening to the former president of Shell Oil, we have enough gas that we can produce that is the combustible gas that we use in our engines. We don't even have to convert to natural gas for our vehicles. We've got shale oil in places in Texas that is 1,000 feet thick. And they are mining that oil up in the Bakken Reserve up in North Dakota. It's incredible. And in Midland and Odessa, Texas, the economies are booming so much because they've discovered different and new ways to find oil that we never knew that we had before. So an oil company executive from Texas who's a church member told me about 4 years ago, Steve, we have got more oil in this country than we can ever use. But that wasn't true back when I was a kid. It's true today through fracking and other means that, you know, the environmentalists don't like us to use. The irony of all of this, we are at the height of our power as a nation. We could be even more powerful. We could be off the dole of Middle Eastern oil altogether, without a doubt, in 5 years, maybe even less, with all the drilling they could do in the Gulf of Mexico, which, you know, politically is incorrect now because of the oil spill several years ago, which some argued with me. It was a horrible accident, and it got a lot of fish dead and oily and all that kind of stuff. But if you fill up the Louisiana Superdome with salt water and pour a can of Coke into the concentration of one of the world's largest buildings, that in the Gulf of Mexico is how much oil proportionally was spilled. I mean, it's horrible that it did, but, and I'm not meaning to discount it, but it wasn't the Valdez oil spill in Alaska of years ago, which was horrid by proportion. So, but it figures into the balance of power, and it's very, very interesting. So we have been the world's policemen. So let's take a look at the world's oil production. A lot of people wouldn't have guessed this, that Russia is the largest producer of oil in the world in terms of billions of barrels per day. We're a thirsty nation, and we don't produce enough for ourselves, but we could. It's a sidebar to the whole thing, and it shows how we have not loosened the dependence. You know, President Nixon started the Energy Department 40 years ago. And the idea was that the Energy Department was going to be started to help us to get ourselves rid of our dependence on Middle Eastern oil.
It has done nothing. It is a government department. I hope that they're not coming after me. I'm a little paranoid, but this is not hate speech, but you never know. I mean, they might send the IRS to investigate me for saying these things, but it has done nothing to help the United States produce more oil. It's, you know, even if they did, you know, the EPA would be on the other hand to, enhance their restrictions so that would limit drilling. So Saudi Arabia is the world's second largest producer. And, you know, one of the reasons we're protecting the Gulf of Suez and the Straits of Hormuz. And then we have Iran, China. That one was surprising as I did the research. And you know where they're getting some of their, you know where they're going now to export oil, to produce oil? They're going to places like Africa. They're going to places like right off of Cuba where they've discovered and that could be our oil. That could be our oil between Florida and Cuba. Huge reserves of oil that are easily accessible. But, you know, it's horrible for us to drill for oil and water. We can't do it off of California. Can't do it in Alaska where the incredible reserves are still there. The polar bear might get black oil all over it. I don't know. So take a look. Saudi Arabia, Iran, Iraq, United Arab Emirates, and Kuwait. When you take a look and add up everything that they do, about 26% of the world's oil produced just by those nations alone. There are other ones that are smaller that produce. But just as a rough figure, about 26% of the oil that is used by the world is produced in the Middle East and flows through the sea gates that we've talked about. And the United States has been happy to patrol those waters and provide safe passage for them. Because, again, there are terrorists that would like to limit that, and we'll get into who those folks are. But all through the rest of the world, when you take a look at the vital passages and take a look at who has controlled those vital passages and sea lanes and sea gates, those areas, and who has made it possible for the commerce to pass through the world, I mean, only a dullard could fail to see that God has blessed our nation and the British peoples so abundantly that it's just unbelievable. And by so doing, we've kind of helped raise the stakes for all the rest of the world as well and made a lot of other countries wealthier than they ever would have been without that kind of protection. So Psalm 83 doesn't talk about Islam. It does talk about the nations that we know are now Islamic. And there are a number of peoples that are mentioned here in this particular passage. Do not keep silent, O God. Do not hold your peace. And do not be still, O God. The psalmist is crying out for God to exact the revenge that he can't on his own. He's crying out for God to perform justice. It is a prophecy that has been partially fulfilled through history. It is a prophecy of the end time as well. It is a prophecy showing what things are going to happen by these groups of people that we've seen are basically the Islamic nations. And where did they come from? Do not be still, O God, for behold, your enemies make a tumult. Well, that's very, very true. I mean, you saw it in the Arab Spring. Not that that was a fulfillment of this prophecy, but you see the kind of tumult that is raised in those nations. Like, for instance, when the Twin Towers were struck down, you could go to almost any of those Islamic nations we looked at, and there would have been demonstrations in the street, demonstrations of joy over what happened, demonstrations that those towers came down in a heap, in a fiery heap. They were excited, they were anxious, they were excited, they made a tumult. Those who hate you have lifted up their head, and they have taken crafty counsel against your people and consulted together against your sheltered ones. If there are any group of people that have been sheltered throughout what I'll just call the time of the end, let's call it the time from when you were born. Does that sound good? Do you think you have grown up in a sheltered society, a blessed society? Well, the rest of the world does if you don't. If you don't think you are some of the richest citizens on the face of the earth,
I guarantee you these folks do think you are. And we have, all of us have to admit it, we have been so abundantly blessed to be the descendants of Abraham and his righteousness. And that is what has given us what we have. It's not been by our own devices. It hasn't been because we have the greatest natural resource. There are a lot of, all nations have some natural resources. One of the greatest natural resources we do have in this nation is like a 500-year supply of coal, which, you know, half of our power plants in the United States used, burn it to use electricity. They burn it fairly cleanly. They could do a good job. And now somebody wants to shut all those coal-producing states down and coal-producing plants and factories. And, you know, I mean, it is unbelievable the resources that we have been blessed with. It's just, and the idea that resources were diminishing in the 70s, all of that and all the fear-mongering about we're losing our supply of oil, gas, natural resources, all of that, it turns out, was a hoax. Right now, we are at the pinnacle, the peak of our power. We can't extract it. I mean, we can't extract it fast enough. It's there for the taking. But most of my life, I grew up as a product of modern education and fear-mongering and nuttiness about natural resources, that we were losing all of those and we had to conserve them. And as a result of learning what I've learned, I've set my air conditioning to a constant 70 degrees. Because I know that we can't run out. I have to pay for it. It's getting a little hot in here, by the way. Not my hot air, is it? But they have said, come and let us cut them off from being a nation, for the name of Israel may be remembered no more. You know, as a student of Bible history, that Israel's name was placed on his grandson's heads, Ephraim and Manasseh. This is the end game, folks, the extermination of modern-day Israel. Who wants to do it? The subjects of Psalm 83. That is the attitude, that is what we are up against, not in a biblical way, but certainly in a secular way. That's what President Bush figured out very early on in his first term, that those folks want to do us harm. And, of course, other presidents have had to deal with it. But Israel is our name. They want to, not Judah, not just the modern nation of Israel, though that's included in the whole process, because we are looked upon as the huge Satan. They're looked upon as little Satan, and they are little. 7.7 million people against 500 million. Are you kidding me? These people are so resourceful that they have invented a defense mechanism, which is called the shield, which all these missiles that are launched from the Gaza Strip and from the Palestinian Liberation Organization and so on and so forth, they're able to repel them because they shoot them down before they get there. It's an ingenious system. And you got to give them their due. They're incredibly smart and they know how to defend themselves. They want to blot off Israel, for they have consulted together with one consent. Now, that's something that these folks haven't quite figured out yet how to do. But when they do, Katie, bar the door. For they have consulted together with one consent, they form a confederacy against you. Interesting. And the tents of Edom and the Ishmaelites, Moab and the Hagrites, Gebel, Ammon and Amalek, Philistia with the inhabitants of Tyre, Assyria is also joined with them. They have also helped the children of Lot. Deal with them as with Midian, as with Sisera, as with Jabin at the brook Eshron. Sisera was the king that had the tent peg poked through his head by Jael, if you'll remember, in the book of Judges, who perished at Endor, who became as refuse on the earth. Make their nobles like Oreb and like Zeb, yes, all their princes like Zeba and Zalmunna, who said, let us take for our possessions the pastures of God for a possession. In the Bible story, when Stephen was growing up, I asked him, we were reading Basil Wolverton's Bible story to them, and all the kings that Israel captured, I used to ask, and you remember I used to ask you this question, what did Israel do to the captured kings? They stood on their necks.
Remember? That's the way Basil Wolverton brought it out, that all of these individuals, Oreb, Zeba, Zeba, and Zalmunna, all of them taken captive by Joshua and the people of Israel. But now they're on the end of Israel, modern-day Israel, is on the receiving end, because these folks are going to say, let us take for ourselves the pastures of God for a possession. That is the end goal. That is what they want. Oh my God, make them like the whirling dust, like the chaff before the wind, as a fire burns the woods and as the flame sets the mountains on fire. So pursue them with your tempest and frighten them with your storm. Fill their faces with shame that they may seek your name, O Lord. So it's not just an imprecatory psalm, which is a psalm where the writer is asking, in this sense Asaph is asking for the destruction of his enemies. He's actually looking forward to God calling them at some time in the future. Let them be confounded and dismayed forever. Yes, let them be put to shame and perish, that they may know you, whose name alone is the Lord, are the Most High over all the earth. And that's going to happen at the time of the end. We are guaranteed that fulfillment of Bible prophecy. There has been minimal fulfillment of this verse, and this chapter rather, in history. Very minimal. It's happened a little bit, but very minimally. The mysterious light. Am I finished? Is it somewhere else? Is there controls that... I thought you had total control over this, Mr. Lewis. Let's take a look at the modern names of these particular nations, or where we think. Now, this is probably as accurate as where we think the modern tribes of Israel from Genesis 49 and Deuteronomy 33 is. It's not exact, but, you know, there's migration, there's intermarriage, but can you put your finger on anything? Well, I don't know how much is accurate, but we do know that Jacob's brother was Esau, and Edom is Esau. They're interchangeable. Garner Ted Armstrong wrote a very excellent article, and I think it's 1967. You can look it up. It's either in the Good News or the Plain Truth, entitled Turkey and Prophecy. And it was written at that particular time, and we thought that it may include only the Turkish peoples because they were the dominant force for 400 years in the Ottoman Empire. If I didn't say this before, then I can send this to you by email. I said that, didn't I? I mentioned it. I sent it to some of the folks before I left services today. I sent you, as long as you have PowerPoint on your computer, it's, you know, there's nothing proprietary here. You're welcome to have it. Ishmael was the first son of Abraham from his wife's handmaiden, Hagar. They were sent away, as you know. Believe that maybe these may be the Arabs from North Africa to Iraq, all the way across the top of Africa, all the way across to Iraq. Moab was descended from Lot, Abraham's nephew. We believe that they may be the Palestinians, the people that are in the area of known as Palestine, right next to the modern nation of Israel, many of them displaced, or at least their ancestors displaced when Israel took over the land in 1948. Hagarites from Hagar, who was obviously the mother of Ishmael. Arabs of Syria. There are different groups and factions in Syria. Some of them are vying for control. The despot dictator who's in charge now in Syria, Hassan, is the son of his father, who was a former despot dictator, and he has succeeded him. I think his father died of kidney failure or liver failure or something, and now his son is the absolute dictator. More on that. I hope I'll try to remember that. More on Syria in a little bit. There's some confusion over the meaning of Gabel, but some scholars feel it may be mountains. Maybe these folks migrated to southern Jordan, the area of Petra. There's not a whole lot of people living there. Ammon is pretty easy to pinpoint because the Bible says that these people settled on their lees and they didn't move. And so Ammon is still their capital. It's Rabbah in the Bible.
It's right next to the, it's just to the east of Jerusalem. So the Jordanians, the Palestinians, most people would say the Jordanians from the time of the Six-Day War in 1967 with King Hussein, most folks would say that he became more moderate as a leader of the Jordanians, and a lot of people would say that the Jordanians are more of a moderate group of people. Amalek, they moved into South Canaan, and actually they presented problems. The Amalekites, you'll remember, attacked Israel from behind, and they were probably the first known terrorists that are preserved in the Bible because they attacked women and children as Israel's trying to make its way into the Promised Land. And then they gave fits to Israel through its history. And some think that they migrated to Central Asia, some Turks, maybe other countries. Philistia, well, you know, the Philistines were a major source of problems for Israel during the time of the Judges. The Gaza Strip, which we'll see, seems to be where they settled. Tyre, that's kind of difficult. Maybe Lebanon, maybe parts of South Europe. And Assyria, in this sense, you might get confused with Assyria being the Assyrians that migrated to Northwest Europe. But in this sense, from Psalm 83, it seems to be the people that live in northern Iraq now, because that's where Assyria used to be. Now, this is where I really wanted to do a little bit of study, and you can go wild with this, and I suggest you do. I mean, not to go overboard with it, but to understand the difference between the groups of Islam and why there are some who consider themselves moderate, why there are some who consider themselves radical, and what it takes for somebody to become radicalized. And I'm amused, though, when I hear, like in the early part of 2001, or even before the Twin Towers were hit, I remember President Bush saying that Islam was a religion of peace. Well, maybe somebody could make accusations against Christianity, but Islam in much of its history has not been a religion of peace. I mean, we weren't alive during the Crusades, but that was a time when they raised a tumult. So the Sunni Muslims comprise 90% of all of Islam. So in all of the countries we've looked at, most of their populations would be Sunni Muslims, and they adhere to the idea that there were four caliphs or religious or civil leaders who succeeded Muhammad, and they believe in that succession of those four individuals that replaced Muhammad. They believe in predeterminationism, which is kind of interesting, that if you think your fate is basically sealed from the time that you're born, then maybe it's easy to don a vest with explosives on it and give your life to Allah. I don't know. They believe in governing by consensus through election. And that is the reverse of what happened with President Morsi forcibly taking during the Arab uprising, the Arab Spring last year, taking the rulership and deposing Hosni Mubarak, another basically evil dictator who was our friend. And some think that he was the one responsible for ordering the hit on Anwar Sadat. The mitigating factor is that he has been our friend. Now he's on trial, and that trial has been postponed. And who knows what's going to happen after, you know, what has been a reversal of the Arab Spring. And by the same token, if most of the Muslims in the Muslim world and in Egypt are Sunni Muslims, these folks basically believe in governing by consensus and by election. And so maybe, if you're a fan of predeterminism, you could have said, well, this religious Arab Spring is destined to fail because these people don't believe in that. And in fact, most of the people in Egypt are not a part of the Muslim Brotherhood. I'm not saying that it's not growing, but it's just kind of interesting that things have been changed. Now, when bread costs $10 a loaf, that really changes things for people. And, you know, they've suffered some economic backlash. But that's what the Sunnis believe. The next group are the Shiite Muslims. And they differ from the Sunni Muslims, and they are the minority. And the only place where they have a significant population that is very great of the Shiite Muslims is in Iran. And coincidentally, Iran was the first country to depose a leader who was a dictator because for religious reasons. You remember when that was? In 1978, 1979, the Shah of Iran, whom we installed as a nation to lead that nation because we saw the Persian heritage and so on and so forth. And then, of course, our embassy, the Canadian embassy, was eventually overrun. Our people were taken hostage. Thankfully, they all lived through it. But the Shiite Muslims believe that the rightful successor to Muhammad was his son-in-law, Ali. And again, their greatest concentration is in Iran. Their belief is that their rightful successor will be the last caliph who will appear, the last religious leader. And I think that they believe that he will unite all of Islam together at the end of the world. And he very well may be that person. We'll get to that when we get to Daniel. This group believes in the five supports of unity, prophecy, resurrection, imamate, and justice. Not at all what we believe in. Not anything in the same way that we look at all of those terms. They're all vastly different. But the imamate is the universal authority in all secular and religious affairs. And that is why Iran, with a predominant group of Shiite Muslims, is governed and has been governed by religious leaders. And that is why Egypt is no longer governed by a religious leader, because most of those folks don't accept it. Now, that's not the entire answer, obviously. Continuing. These are minor sects, but the first one is probably the most scary and the most influential in all of Islam, because these are the folks, these Wahhabis, who are responsible for the educational system in Saudi Arabia. And they have spawned 86 similar groups throughout the Islamic world. And they basically teach, well, we'll get to what they teach about Israel and why, when you look at it from just a secular viewpoint, from a humanistic viewpoint, Israel has no chance of survival because of what they teach and what has been predominant in the schools of Saudi Arabia for the last 25 years, at least. What those kids are taught in their textbooks about the Jewish people is criminal. There's the Sufis, and this very, very minor sect seems to be the most peaceful sect. They have their headquarters in Israel, Baha'ism. They also, I think, have some sects in places like India. The Wahhabis are the most radical. They set the tone and education for what we call radical Islam. And actually, when you read through the Quran, if Quran is the holy book of Islam, it begins in a gentle, peaceful way, mimics some Christian thoughts, succeedingly gets more and more strident until the infidel is anybody who does not believe and must be put to death if he doesn't succumb to Islam. So, but they are responsible for setting the tone in radical Islam, and radical fundamental Islamic thought has been on the increase in the last 30 years. The adherents to this school of thought include Al-Qaeda, which was founded by Osama bin Laden in the late 70s, and the Muslim Brotherhood, which now has just suffered a serious setback in the nation of Egypt. The Muslim Brotherhood, Al-Qaeda, these are individuals that are in the same bed together. These are the individuals that our president in his first term thought might be able to go and show all of these folks and change their minds and help them to become, not be so radical, not hate us so much. And what he did not understand, can you bring me my Bible, Stephen? I'm sorry. What he did not understand is that it's in that gray case. Oh, sorry. Marsha, what did you do with my briefcase?
Oh, somewhat embarrassing. Can you bring this to me, please? So turn to Isaiah 3. Oh, my. I was never hard on my children. Sorry about that, son. Public apology. Don't hold your breath waiting on another one. Okay. This sets the tone for what I was about to say, Isaiah chapter 3. For behold, the Lord of hosts, takes away from Jerusalem and from Judah the stock and the store, the whole supply of bread and the whole supply of water, the mighty man and the man of war, the judge and the prophet, the diviner and the elder, the captain of 50 and honorable men, the counselor and the skillful artisan and the expert enchanter. I will give children to be their princes, and babes shall rule over them. What we have lost recently is the Teddy Roosevelt school of diplomacy, which said basically, walk softly and carry a big stick. Because in this world, people do not respect peaceful intentions. You know, we covered in the public seminar a couple of weeks ago, Micah 5 and verse 7, and it says that Israel shall be like a lion in the midst of the forest. If he walks through, he tears in pieces, and basically shows that, you know, there's a big dog on the block, and you better not mess with him. So what treating nations with apologies only invites is more attacks, because the nations of this world and the nations that are surrounding Israel are like a bunch of jackals. Do you think if they didn't think that they could have driven Israel into the sea, they wouldn't have done so already? But because God has not allowed it, and because they're afraid after losing like four wars in a row of what would happen. And, you know, you never know. So, I will give children to be their princes, and babes shall rule over them. The people will be oppressed, every one by another, and every one by his neighbor. The child will be insolent to his elder. We have to understand this from a national point of view. And from a national point of view, we have arrived at a time in history where leaders really don't understand the world around them, don't understand what is happening. Or if they do understand, there's a purposeful determination to reduce the effectiveness of the power that we have. Now, we are, make no doubt about it, we are losing ground day by day, but we're still more powerful, and nobody wants to mess with the United States of America, and even with Britain, because they know that they will go through and tread and tear in pieces if they have to. The Wahhabists are the most radical. They've set the educational tone, and again, their adherents include this group. One of their spokesmen was quoted as saying, they, the Jews, are the people of the Sabbath. And Sean Hannity often quotes this because Morsi from Egypt has said the same thing, and he was of the Muslim Brotherhood. They, the Jews, are the people of the Sabbath, whose young people God turned into apes, and whose old people God turned into swine to punish them. As cited in Ibn Abbas, the apes are Jews, the keepers of the Sabbath, while the swine are the Christian infidels of the communion of Jesus. That has been exported throughout the entire Arab world. And that is why, after 30 years of this kind of educational program, why people cheer in the streets of Syria and even Lebanon and in Cairo and in Addis Ababa and in virtually every capital of the Arab world when something bad happens to America. It's very unfortunate. It's like I told you the story about my friend that worked at the company that I work for, and her husband sold helicopters. That was back when we were selling. We still do sell a lot of military equipment. And in the 80s, it would have been in the 80s that they were there, maybe the early 90s, they were selling these helicopters that are made up in Mesa by a division of Boeing, I think. Anyway, they're unbelievable helicopters. And but they were stationed over in Egypt for a while, and she decided to go on a tour of a Egyptian museum, and they have one of these cycloramas in a great big room, and taking little third graders and fourth graders through there, and she was walking through on a general tour with herself, and they said to the teacher, well, what is this? And, well, this is a picture of our, this panorama of events. You know what a cyclorama is, don't you? It's a painting of a historical, they have them at Gettysburg, and they have them at various places around the country, paintings that depict the sequence of events. This is the very famous Six-Day War in which we defeated the Israelis, 1967. I mean, have you been taught that propaganda in your life? I mean, then that's what they do. So that type of thinking has been exported through the Arab world. The Muslim Brotherhood then has its origin in Saudi Arabia, 86 branches throughout all the Arab world. One of their spokesmen, every night when I go to bed, I pray to wake up the next day to see Israel is wiped off the map. That's the thinking that we're dealing with. Our president goes to these nations and thinks he's dealing with reasonable people, or thinks that by appeasement or by apologizing for our actions of imperialism through the years, which I don't know where anybody got that, but be that as may, that's exactly what happened. So this is not hate speech. This is just factual reporting of what actually happened several years ago. Naivete abounds, or stupidity abounds, or whatever. But this is what the world is facing. Okay, Hamas is the Islamic resistant movement that is in Palestine today. A very vicious group. Their former leader was Yasser Arafat, and Israel tried to negotiate for years, with Yasser Arafat, gave away 90% of the West Bank, much more than Hamas, Yasser Arafat, had asked for. When it came down to negotiations, they denied it. Didn't take the deal. They don't want peace, because once the Arab world deals with the Palestinian Liberation Movement and the Hamas, well, it's Palestinian Liberation Movement was Yasser Arafat's movement. Sorry. This is a slightly different one. But if there's peace, there's no more need for agitation. And there is not going to be any settlement with Israel that does not include the taking of Jerusalem and the entire city, not just the old city where the Temple of Omar, the Mosque of Omar, is located, where we think the foundation of the original Temple of God was. But these are Sunnis of the Palestinian area. They have governed the Gaza Strip since 2007, and they are an offshoot of the Muslim Brotherhood. Then there is Al-Qaeda. Next slide. We know founded by Osama bin Laden. I thought I'd misspelled that for a second. I thought I'd put the wrong first word there, but we won't go into that. Founded by Osama bin Laden and founded in Pakistan. Secret little joke to myself when I'm amusing myself, Sam. Sorry. Had its origins with the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan. There's a very interesting book. I meant to pull it off the shelf this morning, but I forgot it. It's entitled Charlie Wilson's War. They made a movie of the movie by the same name. It's true. Tom Hanks stars in it. I don't know if you like Tom Hanks. It is true to the book in virtually every area, but it doesn't go into the detail that a 400-page book. Charlie Wilson was a congressman, a Democrat congressman from Lufkin, Texas, which means in today's world he would be an arch conservative. He had been a member of the Navy, had been decorated as a member of the Navy, and he hated the Soviet Union, absolutely hated the Soviet Union. He was well positioned in the 70s and the 80s. He was on many committees, and he was able to fund, first beginning with Jimmy Carter and then with President Ronald Reagan, he was able to funnel billions to the Afghan resistance movement and made deals with Egypt and Israel, cooperating with each other under the table. Nothing you hear about in the news, obviously. But he secretly funded with billions and billions of dollars that they just kind of siphoned off and bought arms for the Afghan rebels, many of them still in use today against us as a nation. One of the things that they funded the Afghan rebels that changed the complexion of the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan and eventually repelled that invasion was the advent of the Stinger missile, the missiles that could shoot down the very powerful helicopters that were basically roaming the countryside and keeping the Afghan people in check. That's how the tide was turned. It had its beginning with Osama bin Laden, who at that time was a leader of that movement. Strange. You know, they say politics makes strange bedfellows. This is the insignia for Hamas. It says something about Allah is the greatest or whatever here. But, you know, if peaceful means don't suffice, then there's always the sword. And that's the belief of the movement, Hamas. Now, let's go to the next slide where it shows this skinny little area. This is the West Bank that you hear so much of. And where that red line is, the Israelis have built, in some cases, they built 40 or 50 feet high concrete walls. That's how they control their borders. I'm not sure how we control our borders, but we don't have 40 to 50 foot high concrete barriers. But here's the prize. Make no doubt about it. Jerusalem. That's the object. And the Bible shows that it's the object of the desire of all Muslims. There are three holy places in Islam. There's Mecca, number one. There's Riyadh, number two. And there's Jerusalem, three. Now, there's two areas in the world, as both Sunnis and Shiite Muslims and the Wahhabis all rest to believe. There are the areas that have been conquered by Islam and are Islamic now, and the areas that have not been conquered yet by Islam. That's a fundamental tenet. That's a fundamental belief. Areas that are Islam, areas that will be Islam. It just so happens that this entire area was once Islam, and it's not anymore. Since 1948, it has not. The Ottoman Turks were kicked out, and the Jews came in and took over. And so that's one of the reasons. Is that as clear as we can get that? I don't know. I don't know that it's essential, but I guess it is. Well, now that we've reached a little more clarity, then let's go to the next slide. Prophecies of the end time. Daniel 11, verse 40. You're very familiar with this. At the time of the end, the king of the south shall attack him. We don't know who that will be, and we don't know where it will come from. It could be a caliph. It could be the last civil religious leader of this confederation of nations, 500 million strong and counting. They have a very high birth rate. But we don't know if it'll come from maybe a nation like Egypt. It's possible. I mean, when I first came into the church, the leader of Egypt was King Fossil. He was old, but that it was spelled F-A-I-S-E-L, I believe. you got it. Okay. Brownie points to Irma. We don't know if it'll merge from one country or an insignificant country. We don't know if he'll be a religious and civil leader that will unite all of these various kingdoms and all of these various groups of Arabs. But he will come from an area that is not of Judah. We do know that. And the king of the north shall come against him like a whirlwind with chariots, horsemen, and many ships, and he shall enter the countries overwhelmed, and that is the king of the north, and pass through. He shall also enter the glorious land. And many countries shall be overthrown, but these shall escape from his hand, Edom, Moab, and the prominent people of Ammon, Jordan, today,
basically. They'll escape from the king of the north's grasp. So there will be some kind of concordat or some kind of agreement where they are not a part of it, because they have been more moderate than most Islamic nations. We know a lot of people from Jordan, and they come over here. They're nice folks. They're very nice folks. We know a number of Jordanians. They're more moderate. Maybe that's the reason. But he shall stretch out his hand against the countries, the king of the north, and the land of Egypt shall not escape. He shall have power over the treasures of gold and silver and over all the precious things of Egypt. Also the Libyans and the Ethiopians shall follow at his heels. Let's take a look at this map once again. Is this the precious things of Egypt coming up through the Suez Canal? Because I don't know that there are any great mineral deposits or any other great discoveries in Egypt so far. It's basically a land of sand and artifacts and museums and great tourist attractions and the pyramids and everything else. But as far as, you know, this is the one country in the Middle East that apparently has no oil, none, dry as a bone with water and with oil. But they do have this, the Suez Canal. And all of these countries, it says, shall follow at his steps. So that entire area is going to be in subjugation to the king of the north. And it says in Daniel that he's going to plant his palaces. In Daniel, I don't think I have it in this passage, but in Daniel 11, going on from there, it says of the king of the north, just like, well, maybe I do. Hold on, let's go back here. I think instead of looking it up. Nope. Wrong passage. Let's go back, Joe. Sorry. Always helps if I give you the right direction, but. So Daniel 11 and verse 44, it says, "But news from the east and from the north shall trouble him, and therefore he shall go out and with great fury to destroy and annihilate many. And he shall plant the tents of his palace between the seas and the glorious holy mountain. Yet he shall come to his end, and no one will help him." Just in the same way that Antiochus Epiphanes planted his headquarters in the temple of God in Jerusalem, offered up sacrifices to pagan gods, this Greek leader. That was a prior fulfillment of this prophecy coming to pass. It will happen again. Now, this next passage I call good news for Jerusalem and bad news for just about everybody else. Everybody else. Zechariah 12, the burden of the Lord against Israel. "Thus says the Lord, who stretches out the heavens, lays the foundation of the earth, and forms the spirit of man within him. Behold, I will make Jerusalem a cup of drunkenness to all the surrounding peoples when they lay siege against Judah and Jerusalem." And that will be for the king of the north. That'll be for all of Islam, all of the Muslim countries that are intent on making Jerusalem theirs. "And it shall happen in that day that I'll make Jerusalem a very heavy stone for all peoples. All who would heave it away will surely be cut in pieces." The answer to the prayer of the spokesman for the Arab people, who said, I go to bed every night and pray that Israel be wiped off the face of the map. Sorry, as my granddaughter says, that's not going to happen. Good news for Jerusalem, bad news for anybody else that feels that way. "In that day, says the Lord, I will strike every horse with confusion and its rider with madness. I will open my eyes on the house of Judah and will strike every horse of the peoples with blindness." So at the end time, we know that, going on here, read verse 5. "And the governors of Judah shall say in their heart, the inhabitants of Jerusalem are my strength in the Lord of hosts, their God. In that day I will make the governors of Judah like a fire pan in the woodpile, like a fiery torch in the sheaves, and they shall devour all the surrounding peoples on the right hand and on the left. But Jerusalem shall be inhabited again in her own place, Jerusalem. The Lord will save the tents of Judah first, so that the glory of the house of David and the glory of the inhabitants of Jerusalem shall not become greater than that of Judah. In that day the Lord will defend the inhabitants of Jerusalem. The one who is feeble among them in that day shall be like David,
Now, if you go back to Psalm 83, a prior fulfillment, a historical fulfillment of that particular verse is that David indeed squared off against all 10 of those peoples that are mentioned in Psalm 83 and defeated them all. Defeated them all. So even the most feeble in Judah is going to be like David, is going to be like the king of Israel. And the house of David shall be like God, like the angel of the Lord before them. It shall be that in that day I will seek to destroy all the nations that come against Jerusalem. So now, where are we? Likely scenario. I don't know. Your guess is as good as mine at this particular stage. Will it be a matter of the Middle East oil supply that is coveted? Will that be the power over the treasures of gold and silver and all the precious things of Egypt? Will it become a modern crusade, or will it be a combination of both? I tend to think that at least there will be some elements of protection of Jerusalem for the sake of protecting Christianity from the king of the north and the beast and the false prophet. I think that that's very likely. Daniel 11:45, I guess I had this in my notes and I didn't realize it. He's going to plant the tents of his palace. Does that mean that the beast and the false prophet together, or the false prophet will be there? Possibly, very likely, will be there in the end. And it's all going to come to naught, as we know. Now, we know this, Mark 13 and verse 14, when you see the abomination of desolation spoken of by Daniel the prophet, standing where it ought not, let the reader understand, then let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains. So even though we've read in the previous prophecy in Zechariah that God is going to intervene on Judah's behalf and Israel's behalf, and he's going to strike all of those nations that come against Jerusalem, if you happen to be in Jerusalem when armies surround it, get out. That is the message. Because just like in 70 AD or 66 AD, when there was a warning that the Romans were surrounding Israel, the Church of God left and they were protected. 1 million Jews were killed 4 years later in Jerusalem by the Roman armies. So if that happens, you don't want to be around. But for the remnant that are there, God is going to intervene after that point. And there's not going to be any Arab Confederacy or anything else. Doesn't matter if it's 500 million or a billion. Obadiah points out in two chapters that they're going to be completely obliterated. Read it. It's a very interesting prophecy, and it shows why. We don't have time to go through it today. Isaiah 63 in the first three verses says the same thing. You know, why are you covered with blood, O mighty one? Or words to that effect. It's because it's a question and answer. It's very poetic, Isaiah 63. It's very poetic. Because I've come to do my bidding, you know, back and forth. It's a beautiful passage if you like gory stuff. Revelation chapter 19 and verse 11 in conclusion. All end up with the same conclusion. All of these prophecies come to the same encouraging end. Now I saw heaven opened, and behold, a white horse, and he who sat on him was called Faithful and True, and in righteousness he judges and makes war. When God does it, it's the right thing to do. Man does it, usually not. His eyes were like a flame of fire, and on his crown were many crowns. He had a name written on him, or written that no one knew except himself. He was clothed with a robe dipped in blood. Obadiah and Isaiah 63 spell out why, because that's going to be the first peoples that he visits, the people who are hostile to the descendants of Israel. The brother that didn't exact his revenge thousands of years ago, 3,500 years ago, is going to attempt it again. And all of his confederates. And they're going to try to annihilate all of the people of modern day Israel. And I'm not just speaking about the Jews. I'm speaking about all of our peoples. And God is going to have his vengeance on them for that attitude and for their jealousy. He was clothed with a robe dipped in blood, and his name is called the Word of God. And the armies in heaven, clothed in fine linen, white and clean, followed him on white horses.
Now out of his mouth goes a sharp sword, that with it he should strike the nations, and he himself will rule them with a rod of iron. He himself treads the winepress of the fierceness and wrath of Almighty God. Godspeed that day when all of these prophecies are fulfilled and the kingdom of God finally comes to fruition.